Support for the morning show comes from the Carthage College Office of Continuing Studies, providing graduate and accelerated certification programs in education to start or advance a career in teaching. Convenient evening and summer courses are designed for the working adult. More information is available at carthage.edu/grad. Support for the morning show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. A unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back. Don't forget about Jack's Cafe, Andrea's, 2401 60th Street, Kenosha, online at andreasgifts.com. Coming up on 11 Minutes After 8, we've got a very short interview with the people from Toys for Tots, and then Professor Arturo will be joining the morning show live at about 8:20.
I'm very, very honored to be able to spend the next few minutes of WGTD's morning show talking with a very busy man at the helm of a very important organization, the Marine Toys for Tots Foundation. I'm speaking today with Lieutenant General Pete Osman, President and Chief Executive Officer. I'm sure many of you know about Toys for Tots, but you may not know very much about the background of how this was created and how the U.S. Marine Corps Reserve have worked very, very hard to make Christmas a little bit happier for children across the country. Lieutenant General Pete Osman, we welcome you to the morning show.
Greg, it's a pleasure to be with you and your listeners this morning.
As I read about Toys for Tots, honestly, I was surprised to learn that it had as long a history as it does. What can you tell us about what sparked the creation of this Toys for Tots program?
Sure. Right after World War II in Los Angeles, California, a young Marine major who was a reservist and his Marines realized that there were going to be some children in the area that were probably going to go without on Christmas. So they collected some toys that year. And on Christmas Eve, they delivered about 5,000 toys to war orphans and other less fortunate children in the Los Angeles area. News of this event took place back in Washington. They heard about it, and the commandant was kind of taken with it and thought, what a great, great, great thing to do for less fortunate children, and also to help the Marine Corps stay connected to the American public. So he directed that in 1948, every reserve unit across the country, and there were 74 in those days, would conduct a Toys for Tots campaign. So that actually began officially as the Marine Toys for Tots program. Over the years, of course, Greg, the program's grown dramatically. In fact, this year, we're going to be conducting 795 campaigns, big cities and small towns all across the country. In fact, those campaigns at this point are pretty much getting to the point where they're in the throes of not only collecting toys, but beginning the distribution process to get everything in place for Christmas morning. So, you know, lots of things going on, and, you know, all with that very small beginning in Los Angeles in 1947.
That's so terrific to see something, such a great idea, grow so dramatically. And when you say across the country, you really mean that literally, because we're talking about a program that has a vibrant presence in every single state and beyond.
That's correct. Yes, we have campaigns in all 50 states, as well as Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and of course Washington D.C. So we really do reach a great part of the country. You never touch every less fortunate child, but we certainly do try to reach as many as we possibly can.
I know that most people are aware of sort of the important part that ordinary citizens play in donating toys, dropping them off at locations, but a little more behind the scenes is a lot of generosity that is given to you by a number of corporate sponsors without whom Toys for Tots would not be quite as spectacularly successful as it is.
You're absolutely right, Greg. I mean, let's face it, the real meat and potatoes behind the Toys for Tots program is the individual donor, that person that will take the time to go out and buy a toy and drop it in one of our barrels, or go to our website and make an online donation. Couldn't do it without the American public. But as you said, corporate sponsors really help fill in some of the blanks. And we've been blessed with wonderful corporate sponsors. The very first one back in 1948 was Disney. They've been with us every year since then. More recently, great support from Toys R Us. In fact, for the last 15 years, they've been our number one corporate sponsor, having helped raise over $50 million and donating millions of dollars worth of toys. Hasbro's a big sponsor, Delta this year. Scholastic has been a great sponsor. So we've been blessed with corporate sponsors that, like I said, really help fill in the blanks through their gift in kind donations as well as monetary donations. We're able to help, if you will, supplement the local toy collections and areas that might have trouble reaching all the less fortunate children that they'd like to reach. So it's the combination of the individual donor together with the corporate sponsor that allows us to reach as many children as possible.
For somebody who has never before donated to Toys for Tots, what are sort of the different options that they have? What do you suggest that people do?
Well, like I said, the number one way for the individual donor to help is when they're out doing their Christmas shopping. Just remember that a less fortunate child's Christmas might be determined on whether or not you remember to buy that toy, and then drop it in one of our barrels. And our collection barrels are located, you know, in shopping malls, other convenient locations where people do shopping at department stores or toy stores. If you can't find a barrel or you're unsure where to go, you can always go to our website, click in your state and county, and the individual website for that particular local campaign will pop up, and they list where they have their drop-off locations. They also list events that are taking place and whatnot. Or, if you don't want to go out and do the shopping, you can just make that online donation. And our website is toysfortots.org. There you can make that online donation, which allows us to buy toys in bulk, again, to help supplement your local campaign or campaigns across the country.
If people go to your website, and it's a handsome website, by the way, I hope they will page down from the very first page, and they will see a very, very impressive chart which spells out how much of the money and donations that you receive go directly to help less fortunate children.
Yeah, Greg, we're particularly proud of the fact that we have a very enviable what we call program to support ratio, and that just means, you know, what percentage of the dollar goes to the program, what goes for overhead, and, you know, we're at the top of the nonprofit, if you will, world when it comes to that. 97% of everything that we collect goes right to the purchase of toys and the distribution of those toys. So that's we take great pride in that, and I can also tell your listeners that not one dime that's ever donated goes to pay anybody's salary. The overhead we have is very small. It mainly is just fundraising costs. And like I said, you make a donation, it's going to go to the individual who needs help.
Right. And speaking of the individual who needs help, it's important for us to mention that on this website is also a place where someone can request a toy. If they are more in a position of need rather than in a position of being able to give or donate. That's something I'd long wondered about, is how do you find the needy children? How do you connect needy children to the toys that they are going to enjoy?
Right. A good question, Greg. Each local campaign coordinator essentially is up to his own imagination as to how to determine which families need help. Most of them will use local social agencies to find out which families in the community need help. In smaller towns, you can actually get that kind of information maybe from local churches. Even the police department oftentimes help coordinators identify families that might need help. And as you said, if you know someone that you a family you know might need help this Christmas, if you go to the website, again, there's a quick on button there where you can identify to the local coordinator a family that you know that's going to need some help at Christmas time. So there are a variety of ways that the coordinator can go about finding out, you know, who in his community needs help, and then, of course, then it's up to him and his volunteers to make that work.
In our closing minute or two, I would love to hear a little bit from you about what prompted you personally to become part of Toys for Tots and what it has meant for you to be such an important part of this effort.
Now, Greg, I'm a blessed man. I had 37 wonderful years active duty in the Marine Corps and retired back in 2006. And as I was looking at retiring from the Marine Corps, my predecessor here at Marine Toys for Tots kind of fingered me and said, "Pete, I think you'd be the right guy." He said, "I'm ready to step down, and would you be interested?" And so after chatting with him and the commandant, decided that it would be a great way for me to, if you will, open a second career. So about 10 years ago, I joined the Marine Toys for Tots program and have had a great ride ever since. It has given me a great opportunity to continue to make a difference for our country, but in a different way.
Hmm. In a very powerful way. We want to remind people that if you want more information about Toys for Tots, you can go to their website, which is simply toysfortots.org, and you will find all kinds of information there about this organization and the great work that they do. And their president and chief executive officer is Lieutenant General Pete Osman. Thank you so much for your good work and for the good work of your organization, and happy holidays to you and everyone at Toys for Tots.
Greg, thank you very much, and Merry Christmas to you and your listeners.
And it's 8:20 here on WGTD, and we have Professor Art Sear coming up very shortly here on WGTD for the morning show. We want to remind you that this weekend, on Sunday at 6 p.m., it is the annual Sing-Along Messiah at First United Methodist Church, which is part of their Fine Arts at First series. And for any of you who have never experienced this in person, it's a performance of Handel's Messiah in which the choruses are sung by most of the audience members. And a quartet of marvelous soloists are joined by a marvelous orchestra to perform extensive excerpts from this masterpiece from the Baroque era. And a young man who has been tenor soloist for the last couple of years will be joining us on Sunday evening, Nick Huff, who has been studying recently at Eastman School of Music. And we are delighted that he can be back as tenor soloist for Sunday evening's performance. Here's just a brief excerpt from his performance last year.
Whoa.
That's tenor Nick Huff. He will be the tenor soloist Sunday night, along with bass Mike Enderle, alto Libby Weisinger, and two sopranos, Jennifer Hansen and Mary Kate Bach, as the soloists with orchestra for this sing-along Messiah Sunday, 6 p.m. at First United Methodist Church, which is at the corner of 60th Street and Sheridan Road. Admission is free, and they have plenty of scores. So if you happen not to own your own score of Handel's Messiah, one can be lent to you if you want to be one of them, one of the lucky folks singing along to this great, great masterpiece. Also this weekend, Saturday night, is the annual Christmas concert of the Kenosha Pops Band. That will be at Carthage College in beautiful Siebert Chapel, Saturday evening beginning at 7 p.m. And there are two performances this weekend by the highly regarded Bell Ensemble of Racine, including a concert Friday night billed as an old-fashioned Christmas concert at Holy Communion Lutheran Church, the Bell Ensemble under the direction of Nick Berutian. Well, for the remainder of the hour, I'm really glad that we can be talking on today's morning show with a very good friend of the morning show, namely Professor Art Sear, who is Clausen Distinguished Professor at Carthage College, Distinguished Professor of Political Economy and World Business. And of course, as you know, he joins us once a month on the morning show to offer his analysis of current events. And Professor Sear, we welcome you back to the morning show. Glad you can be here on this cold winter morning.
Well, thank you, Greg. Especially for a warm greeting on a cold morning, as the cow said to the farmer.
Well, we have a lot to talk about, of course. And since your last visit to the morning show, among the most dramatic events, and one of them which you wrote about, was the death of Fidel Castro,
yes,
who, of course, for many decades was the leader of Cuba. And of course, although he had stepped down from any active role in the government for some time, he still, in many respects, represented Cuba, both to his own people and to the outside world, right up to the day he died.
Yeah.
A lot has been written about him. What do you think is most important for us to remember about Fidel Castro and who he was and how he led the Cuban people?
Well, when someone passes away, it's customary to say, to emphasize the positive. Given my perspective on the world, that's a little challenging. That's not a question I expected. I think his long durability, a remarkable Machiavellian survivor and leader, as you indicate, de facto, after he turned over the reins of power to his younger brother, Raul, the enforcer, Castro, their ability to stay in power is really quite remarkable. It also should encourage modesty on the part of, especially with unpredictable new administration in Washington coming in, it's fair to say. The U.S. tried for many years. It reached a height during the Kennedy administration, but started during the Eisenhower administration, and continued in less violent ways thereafter.
Hmm.
We tried very, very hard to remove that regime. The brothers endured a number of American presidents, and it certainly shows the limits of power and the necessity to think and reflect very carefully before you try to overthrow somebody else's country.
Hmm. I want to read one intriguing line from your column about Mr. Castro.
Well, I'm glad there was one.
Oh, for sure, there was at least one.
Hey, thank you so much. That's why I come back. Right.
So you write this, I mean, particularly after remarking about Mr. Castro's remarkable longevity,
yeah,
in leading Cuba, but you write, slowly but also surely, the ruthless dictatorship which controls Cuba has been forced to face the reality of the economic failure of communism. Tell us the ways in which this has played out in Cuba. I mean, what has been the nature and the scope of that failure, and what sort of effect did that ultimately have on the regime?
Fidel Castro had serious health problems for at least a decade before he died. He did reemerge from uncharacteristic silence and lack of visibility in the global media in 2006, I believe, to publicly and bluntly announce the failure of communism in Cuba. And from that time forward, the regime has, he indicated that, in effect, he was going to revive his regime by putting Raul in power, and that they were giving priority to opening things up economically. It was dictated by reality, the Soviet Union, until it collapsed, and for a while thereafter, Russia provided basic, enormous financial support to Cuba. That stopped as Russia itself confronted some hard economic realities throughout the 90s, from which Putin, another long-surviving autocrat, has brought Russia back, in effect. The Venezuela government under Hugo Chavez, also now deceased, kind of picked up the Russian role, a major oil producer, and especially when oil prices are high, the regime was able to do quite well, but they weren't able to provide the level of subsidy to what was, in effect, their welfare state client, Cuba. And Venezuela, since Chavez's death, has become a basket case, not just because of the oil markets. So Cuba had to face reality.
Something else you write.
State planning, traditional autocratic and totalitarian dictatorships, and Cuba certainly qualifies as the latter, just don't work. It took us most of the 20th century to learn that lesson. But that lesson is undeniable, even for people on the left.
What you also say in this comment, you've already touched on this, is how it is almost always a foolhardy choice of action when we try to bring down such a dictator, particularly in sort of heavy-handed and ham-handed fashion, as of course was the case with, for instance, the Bay of Pigs. But even in a more overarching way, you say we need to avoid directly attacking the regime. Previous aggressive interventions were highly counterproductive, and for many years have provided the Castro brothers with the benefit of blaming all problems on the Yankee superpower to the north. So in other words, it's not just embarrassing for the United States when we attempt to overthrow a dictator and it fails, but it also, and maybe more significantly, worsens our position in relationship to that country. And that's a cost we have to weigh, and we probably haven't always weighed it as we should.
Yes. Well, thank you again. I sometimes struggle facing a deadline to meet the 600-word optimum column, and I did not consider that point as all that important. You've got to think very prudently and very carefully and plan very thoroughly, which the U.S. government did not do at the top before the Bay of Pigs invasion. President Kennedy, to his credit and to be fair, learned a lot from that lesson, thank God, because he handled the Cuban Missile Crisis, much higher stakes, terrible confrontation with the Soviets the following year, enormously skillfully. Whether it's in the workplace or at home or in the kind of the wider tapestry that we pay attention to of international relations, you've got to think very carefully before you use force. The U.S. has tremendous force, but force is limited. We don't have unfortunately, the kind of domestic thoroughgoing rule of law internationally that the U.S. and increasingly the rest of the world enjoys. You've got to think very, very carefully. But there are times when it's certainly justified. I believe it was during the Eisenhower administration when we intervened in Latin America very, very successfully. I believe it was during the Nixon administration when we intervened, among other places, in Chile. I don't want to be misunderstood on this point. Preaching humanitarianism is pointless in terms of really understanding the best foreign policy for this country. But we've got to think carefully, and to actually answer your question, the brothers Castro got tremendous benefit, tremendous political advantage from constantly pointing to the Yankee, to the North. We have a long history from the early years of this great republic of intervening with force in Latin America, which we've tended to consider our own backyard. Throughout the 19th century, the British fleet permitted us to engage in that rather egotistical view of the world, but there's a long history of hostility on the part of various people in various countries in Latin America towards us, and you've got to think especially carefully regarding Cuba.
Very good.
Regarding Latin American intervention generally, excuse me.
Sure. For those of you just joining us, we're glad to have Dr. Art Sear with us for today's morning show, and we'll get to Mr. Trump in just a couple of minutes. There's a lot to talk about there, but a couple other things I want to make
I've
sure
heard
don't
of him
get crowded.
In the media, yes, right. I'm familiar with that name. Thank you.
But another important name, and I know from a country you know a whole lot about, we need to talk about the really serious troubles which right now are engulfing President Park of Korea.
Yes, thank you.
Just remind our listeners, first of all, the nature of the kind of trouble that she is in and just how serious that trouble is at the moment.
She was impeached by the legislature in South Korea, and that has happened before. It was overturned by the Supreme Court of the country, General Roh, who was elected president, I believe, in 2004, was impeached, but he was ultimately returned to office. That doesn't seem as likely to happen in this case. Basically, the president was impeached for permitting others, very powerful corporate interests, to take advantage of her administration. I don't think she's a criminal. I don't think she's a crook, to quote one of our former presidents. She has been, unfortunately, a very weak leader, and I think she's been very easily taken advantage of, in hindsight, by some people she shouldn't have been associating with, including a kind of Svengali-like or Rasputin-like close, lifelong friend, a woman by the name of Choi, who seems to have exercised entirely too much power and sway over the administration, including reportedly picking the president's wardrobe for her and organizing her daily schedule.
Wow.
Not good when you're the chief executive of any country.
Yeah. What do you think are the prospects for South Korea to weather this tumult in terms of, I mean, you talk so often on this program about their incredibly vibrant economy and their often unsung significance in terms of the overall world stage. Are they? Do you think they are likely to weather this trouble well?
Yes.
All right.
I tend to talk too much, even for a professor. Yes, I think they will. And their commitment to constitutional government, the remarkable talent of the Korean people collectively, will permit them to weather this. The North Koreans may take advantage of this, but history since the Korean War, since the invasion of the South by the North in 1950, directly promoted by and basically launched by the Soviet Union and Joseph Stalin, that kind of precedent will not be repeated, I don't think. But if you're prudent, as we were just discussing, you've got to consider all possibilities.
Right.
It makes the role of China in the region even more important. And this may indeed be the strongest, most important test of the incredible democracy and enormously powerful economy of South Korea, but they've weathered lots of crises, including the Korean War.
Right. And we'll get to China in just a moment. I want you to say a word about some of the dramatic elections that have taken place in a couple of different European countries who are part of the European Union, which continues to be kind of rocked by the emergence of forces that seem, at least in some respects, to be rather hostile to the European Union and, of course, the presence of more and more immigrants and other such issues, in some ways a reflection of how our most recent presidential election here in the United States ended up faring. In your column about that, you really, as you often do and wisely do, caution us to not get kind of distracted by dramatic headlines and lose sight of the sort of quiet, enduring strength of the European Union. I think that's kind of your central message, that the European Union, in a lot of ways that matter, despite certain troubles, seems to be enduring these troubles pretty well.
Well, the idea of the European Union actually emerged in the United States, led by European emigres primarily, including Jean Monnet, one of these larger-than-life historical figures. During World War II, he was from a very influential Jewish merchant family on the continent, and then he fled to Britain, and then he made his way to the United States. It shows just how visionary not just American but Allied leaders were during that war. The European Union was envisioned then, and in effect, with Washington spearheading the efforts, the construction, and it really is a tangible structure, as you indicate, began shortly after World War II, and the goal was not to integrate economies or make rich people richer or facilitate basic trade and investment across Europe. Primarily, it was to prevent war, to keep the Germans in check, get them so involved in Europe that a third horrible war in Europe would be less likely. And it worked. And that's why I try to write as often as possible about modern Germany and Chancellor Merkel. Dwight Eisenhower, at the end of the war, after the surrender of the Third Reich unconditionally on May 8th, 1945, was careful to remind associates, we haven't won the war. We've destroyed the Nazi Reich. We won't know if we won the war for another half century or so if Germany then has embraced the rule of law as it really should exist, not the kind that the Nazis put in place, the one based on due process and precedent and fairness. And they've embraced democracy, then we'll have won the war. And we have won the war. And Americans should feel good about that, since we're inclined to feel badly about so much facilitated by the media. To actually answer your question, right-wing nationalist movements and parties in Austria, where it all began with Adolf Hitler, the right has undeniably been growing stronger over several decades. It was predicted that a very right-wing, virulently nationalist party would win the recent presidential election. That didn't happen. Actually, left-moderate forces prevailed. At the same time, a referendum in Italy, which was strongly supported by the very charismatic young prime minister, was turned down. It was for comprehensive reform of the rather corrupt Italian system. And Renzi has resigned, and there will be new elections. And a lot of people, including a lot of the global electronic media, interprets this as some kind of slap in the face to the European Union. And as usual in the soap opera of our media today, the fear is the European Union will collapse. I don't think that's going to happen.
Right. You write at one point, in kind of an indication of how we tend to gravitate towards certain headlines and maybe throw too much emphasis on them, in talking about the euro, the much-discussed currency common to many nations in
yes.
the European Union, but not all. You're right, the European common currency is an appropriate symbol of the uneven and at times unpredictable course of integration. The euro is used by only 19 of the 28 members of the European Union years after being formally established. The EU would survive demise of the currency unit or withdrawal of several members. We focus too much on news at the expense of long-term goals.
Yes, and that's right, which is why I emphasize the early origins and important origins of the EU. There are very powerful, large-scale corporate interests that are very much in favor of a single market and have been pushing a single currency, which has been in place in real terms for more than a decade, but only part of the union. Currency conversion costs, transportation costs, all kinds of costs for regular people, but also very powerful corporate interests go down. And for that reason, my guess is the euro will survive in some form, even though it is unusual, not unprecedented, but unusual for national, for a currency not to be, that survives, not to be tied to a nation state.
Right.
There is a currency union in Africa, part of Africa, that's weak but survives. The Scandinavians and Latin Europe early in the 20th century had currency unions, but they have tended not to last a long time.
Hmm. Well, we'll watch that with great interest.
Yeah, we should. Mm-hmm. We really should, because it bears whatever happens with the incoming administration. I believe that for larger reasons, other countries are going to become more important in international relations as they have already in the 21st century.
Right.
You make a very important point. It may sound boring, perhaps particularly when I'm talking about it, but these bureaucratic structures, these economic flows, these administrative unions, and endless new regulations and European court decisions, they really are important for us.
Right.
They just don't seem that jazzy.
Right, right. We need to talk about Mr. Trump, and we need to talk about China, because one of your more recent columns talked about his much-discussed phone call to the leader of Taiwan,
yeah,
which stirred up quite a hornet's nest of criticism, of course, from others more positively disposed to Mr. Trump. You know, that was interpreted as, you know, much ado about nothing. Explain what the significance of that phone call was, and why, in certain quarters, it stirred up such fervent concern.
Yeah. In so many words, a lot more words than you just use, I think it's much ado about nothing, basically. But that doesn't mean it is, and the media continues to focus on this as a big, big story. Donald Trump, it's, I think, still unclear whether he initiated the call or took the call.
Mm.
I think it was probably both. Talked directly with Tsai Ing-wen, the new president of Taiwan. Mainland China has been very emphatic over many years that Taiwan is a province of wider China, that you can't recognize both. And they have been very consistent in stating that that would mean war if Taiwan declares independence. President Tsai is the first woman president of Taiwan. Now, that's big news.
Mm.
That's extremely important and, in my opinion, extraordinarily positive.
And nobody talks about that.
Exactly. It's been lost in all the noise.
Right.
Her party, the DPP, is formally committed to independence. She's the second president from that party. They've been able to work it out over time. I believe, contrary to a lot of academic opinion and expert opinion, I believe that Taiwan will continue to become even more important as a banker and source of investment in the mainland. I think the Chinese have less and less incentive to really try to overthrow the regime in Taiwan.
Hmm.
That's a minority point of view, let me stress.
Hmm.
Finally, throughout the Cold War, it was common, certainly in policy circles, to remind ourselves that Russians aren't Germans. Historically, they are, in fact, cautious about using force beyond their borders. We should all keep that in mind today. And Chinese are not Japanese. They, in fact, are reluctant. We were direct combatants with China in the horrible Korean War, and I mean it really, all war is horrible, but that was a particularly gruesome war for the GIs and Marines on the ground,
yeah,
in any POW. China sent 300,000 People's Liberation Army troops south around Thanksgiving 1950, I believe, smashed, we've discussed this recently on your program, smashed UN forces, much of the American force on the ground, not the U.S. Marine Corps, let me stress. They only did that after they had said repeatedly that if U.N. forces approached their border closely, were near the Yalu River, they would do that. They would intervene. Douglas MacArthur not only pressed to do that, and the Truman administration acceded, but he was talking before Truman fired him more and more wildly about using nuclear weapons, destroying China. I believe he saw himself as an agent of the Lord who would destroy communism once and for all. And Truman finally fired him. But that was the context in which the Chinese intervened.
Hmm.
They put up with well over 500,000 American forces, plus our allies, including 50,000 very effective South Korean warriors. I can assure you, effective. A very large South Vietnamese army close to their border. They did overcome traditional hostility to Vietnam and Indochina to aid the North Vietnamese regime, but they never, ever intervened directly.
Hmm.
They are, in fact, reluctant to use force, and since their rhetoric has been military rhetoric has become more bellicose, and they are engaged in a general arms buildup, and they are grabbing islands and pushing the limits in the South China Sea. It's important to keep this longer history in mind.
Hmm. Because it'd be tempting to overreact to some
of these. We already are in terms of our political rhetoric in this country.
Right.
And to a degree, that's not bad. I think it's important to contain them.
Hmm.
But I would be surprised if there were a war. Again, I could be wrong. Dwight Eisenhower faced two very much more serious confrontations in 55 and 58 with the mainland. We came very close to nuclear war in both of these, I want to stress. He was so skillful that he kept one of them out of the headlines completely, and the other one, the second crisis in 58, did make some news, but he was able to avert war. It did become a hot issue in the 60 presidential campaign between Kennedy and Nixon. And Kennedy, who was pursuing a very aggressive line, made a major issue out of China's bombardment of two offshore islands, Quemoy and Matsu, which became a big deal in the campaign. Nixon seized on that to, in turn, become even more hardline than Kennedy about the importance of these islands.
Mm.
Totally forgotten today.
Right. We forget too much, don't we?
We sure. Well, Americans do, especially.
Right. Let's. We don't have too much time, and we do want to hear from you in terms of what this transition has looked like for President-elect Donald Trump, and in particular, of course, the choices he has made for his cabinet. I mean, choices which have yet, of course, to be confirmed. Of course, a lot has been said about the choices that he is making. What is your interpretation of the choices he has made for the men and women that he wants to have with him in his cabinet, in his approaching administration?
They've made a lot of news, and I believe he's turned out to be a genius at dominating the media, something he was very effective at before he became a national politician as a media figure. It's extremely important to him to be seen as a successful big-time business executive, which he is not. He was and is a very successful showman, and it shows the importance of the media and his skill at doing things and saying things that dominate much of the contemporary media. That he's been able to hold attention, and he's discussed nonstop. And at a basic primordial level of profits, the U.S. electronic media actually loves this guy because he's constantly increasing their ratings, it's a kind of an unholy alliance from my academic point of view, but you can see his genius at media manipulation. And a lot of these choices are newsmakers, whether they're good choices or bad. It's hardly unprecedented for big business people to be in U.S. cabinets. Eisenhower had the quip among Democrats and a lot of others at the time was the New Dealers. These younger radical reformers in the 30s under FDR had been replaced by the big dealers. The Kennedy administration, which wound up having a lot of hostility with a lot of the business community. Robert McNamara was the new young dynamic president of Ford Motor Company when he became Secretary of Defense. And this country does have a tradition of putting corporate types, including Charles Wilson, another auto executive, Secretary of Defense under Eisenhower from GM, not Ford. But it's hardly unprecedented to do this. I think a big business type from Big Oil as Secretary of State is pretty unusual. I don't think it's probably a good idea, but at this point, my friend, I'm pretty humble about commenting on national politics.
Or making predictions, at least.
Absolutely, predictions, yeah. I really did not think we would elect Trump or that the Republicans would nominate him. So it's good we're talking about this toward the end of the program, since some of your viewers, listeners may be turning off the... I've had a long career. It's one reason I think I'm a professor. I've had a long career of not being right about some important predictions in the outside world and more personally. But that's what he's demonstrated so far. I think it's good. I don't approve of every military officer he's appointed. I think it's good that we have military experience at the top. General Mattis, despite his off-putting nickname, Mad Dog, he knows the reality of war. He really does. We've just had a president whom I voted for, and I think there were good things about the Obama administration. I'm glad he's leaving, frankly. He certainly has not been reluctant to use force. We've killed an awful lot of people, far more than the Bush administration, electronically, and from an American point of view, safely, by using drone strikes. I believe there's a downside. Obama's been willing to use force as long as it's tech and removed, which Americans generally love. But he talks about these matters often as though he's at a seminar at Harvard Law School or Columbia. Even worse was George W. Bush, also removed from the military, even though he was technically enrolled in the Texas National Guard for a while, thanks to Dad. He talked about war like it was some kind of goddamn video game, at least until we got mired down in Iraq. We really need military experience at the top. Rick Perry is much maligned by the media and opponents for ignorance of certain political facts. He served in the Strategic Air Command and helped man B-52 bombers. I think that kind of experience is far more, it's always necessary, but it's far more necessary than ever before. Sorry to get a little carried away, but I think that the relationship between the military and the wider society is always important, and it's more important today than ever.
Right. Maybe a minute or so for this. What about the matter which really generated some headlines about the fact that Mr. Trump was not interested to take in the daily briefings of intelligence? And also, what is your take on his dismissing of the possibility that the Russians were actively engaged in interfering with our election?
I think anybody in an executive and leadership position needs as much information as possible. Dwight Eisenhower was obsessed with intelligence, and I mean obsessed. It was vital during World War II, and it was vital in the White House. It's perhaps one of the most important jobs of the many demanding dimensions of the U.S. presidency. He used technology the right way. The U-2 aircraft, which is still in use, like the B-52 bomber, incredible. That was his direct initiative. He was obsessed with human intelligence, understandably, during the war, and British brilliance at human intelligence, information gathering as well as deceiving the other guys, was vital then, and that skill remains vital now. I'm very sorry that the incoming president and apparently the outgoing president, to put it mildly, have had a much more cavalier attitude toward these matters.
Hmm. Well, we will be watching the situation very, very carefully as matters unfold, and the matter of whether or not Russia was involved in this most recent election, of course, is also something that a lot of people are watching and wanting to have some answers about. So we'll be having further conversations about that and much, much more in 2017. And I certainly hope you're going to be willing to put the morning show on your regular calendar as it has been for the last few years. These conversations have been invaluable, and we certainly appreciate the time you have given to this program.
Well, you're always kind and you're always serious. You're the anti-Bill Riley, and Merry Christmas.
Professor Art Sear, Clausen Distinguished Professor at Carthage College, thank you again for being here.
Bill O'Reilly.
Tomorrow on the morning show, several different interviews, including one with the author of a fascinating book about a fascinating man, Casanova. There was such a man. He really lived. And his story is a really remarkable one. Also the author of a book called 1,000 Places in the United States and Canada to Visit Before You Die. A really remarkable travel guide about some of the most important places close to home that everyone needs to visit and experience and appreciate. Support for the morning show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911, a unique shopping experience time and time again, and that's what brings you back.